Welcome to B2B, Boots to Books, the show where we explore the journeys of veterans and military-connected students as they navigate their paths from service to the classroom and beyond. I'm Dustin Abrego.
And I'm Rebecca Allen, your hosts. Each week, we'll dive into powerful stories of resilience, determination, and success.
Whether you're a veteran yourself, a military family member, or simply inspired by the strength of those who serve, you're in the right place.
Let's turn the page and start this incredible journey together.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of B2B. I'm Dustin Abrego.
And I'm Rebecca Allen.
How are you, Rebecca?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. People don't know because we've just been talking all morning already about various different things here. So we're going to be doing, would this be a series, I guess? I don't know.
I think so. That's kind of the plan, I think.
What was our actual working title of this, though? Would be... We had something
that I had it listed as jargon.
Jargon, yes. Okay. Yeah. So it'll possibly seem like Rebecca's quizzing me today, possibly. And then I'll get her back for another episode of this time. It's going to be higher education or higher ed jargon. Mm-hmm. I'm a first-gen college student, but I've been working in higher ed. That's what my entire career has been. That's what my master's is in, all the stuff. So I've had to learn a lot of these things. This is your first?
This is my first time working in education. At all. My parents went to universities, but we didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I went to a university many, many years ago. So
we both did at the same time. Don't date me also, please.
I won't say how long it's been, but it's been a while.
It's been a minute. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's different between universities and even a community college.
Yes.
And just trying to understand what some of these terms mean from a professional standpoint. And mm-hmm. I realized that we have a lot of students that are probably in the same boat where they're either, this is their first time going to school, so they're learning these terms for the first time, mm-hmm. or they're either coming from a university or planning on going to a university and things are a little different. So.
And there's lots of different terms and things that maybe students don't interact with on a day-to-day, or they maybe do, mm-hmm. And they're not aware of, or the actual structure of things, or in my experience, it tends to be a lot of, unless you had a parent or a direct person that went to college and was explaining all these things to you, what these things meant, a lot of it's carryover from movies.
Yep.
Just it would be the other way around when we're going to do an episode about military stuff and jargon and stuff, it's going to be, well, this is my assumption because on the screen, it's yeah, that's garbage.
Yep.
So...
So for those of you listening in, I made a list of terms that I keep coming across either in my day-to-day job or in interacting with students or even just talking with other schools, because that's mm-hmm. part of what I need to do is work with other schools. And there is a lot of stuff that doesn't necessarily carry over for me that I want to know. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I want to start with one that I come across a lot, especially when I'm working with Central Michigan, mm-hmm. is president versus dean versus mm-hmm. provost.
Yep.
Because I know that we have a president, yes. and we have deans, and
yes.
I know that we have a provost, mm-hmm. and I don't know what the difference is.
Yeah. To give historical context, I mock some people that I've worked with before that would always say that, but higher education in the form that we would know it in this country really tracks from the UK. In age dating reference, people are why is it to this extent? I believe it's either Oxford or Cambridge. One of those is old enough that it existed before the Aztec civilization came
around.
Was it Oxford?
Yep.
We talked about this before, right?
Yep.
So a lot of this stuff is, why is it called that? It's been like that for hundreds of years. So that's where we're coming at from this way, possibly 1,000 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. So we talk about president versus dean versus provost. Really what we're getting at, I feel like president probably tracks for most people knowing what that means, especially with political state culture, or even private industry, right?
Yep.
This is the face, the person, the big decision maker outside of board of trustees that could be elected or appointed to fit people that then direct the president what to do. Mm-hmm. When we talk dean, depending on the size of the institution, can be treated similarly to a vice president. So for scale and structure, there might be multiple vice presidents if you have a big private company, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have a bunch of different private things within that. And dean is more of the traditional structure from carryover higher ed. And at one point, Central, I think, has now moved to deans and stuff. They had vice presidents. Some schools have a mixture. It's usually the same thing. Mm-hmm. that's one that I always think is interesting, because when I've interacted with parents that are not thrilled with what's going on, possibly in a situation, they'll be like, I'm going to talk to the dean. They usually mean the dean of students, and that tracks from like watching Animal House or something else. That's like the person that like is responsible for like student activities. But like here at LCC, there's a dean for like the individual colleges as well. So we're talking like arts and sciences or health careers, like HHS is the title of like health and human services within that. Like there's deans for that, but treated as a vice president. The provost title is one that doesn't really exist outside of higher ed that I can really track. The provost is the highest ranking academic at the college.
Okay.
So our president here, Dr. Robinson, teaches an English class on the side, but that's not within his primary roles. Mm-hmm. So our provost here, Sally Welsh, she is the highest in the academic world. So like that's essentially the number two at the school.
Okay.
There can be other vice presidents, but like it goes president, then provost. If there's ever presidents that like move on, get other jobs or other things, usually a provost is interim president. They get promoted to that. So really they're like the top vice president, but they're in charge of all the academics at the college, versus you could have a vice president that's in charge of facilities if you have a really big campus and stuff. So,
okay. And the next one, I know we kind of discussed yesterday.
I felt silly that I didn't know offhand, which is really funny.
So this term is bursar.
Yeah.
And for context.
Not bursitis, right? Yeah. And it's not a medical thing. Yeah.
For context, so we have our Center for Veteran and Family Support here and other schools that will be accredited to use GI Bill. Mm-hmm. They will often have other vet services offices as well, but not every school does. So some schools, they'll go through their financial aid office or their registrar's office. And I came across a couple of schools where they said to go through the bursar's office. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what that meant.
Yeah. And I mean, we had to look it up. It was Latin for
purse.
Yeah, for purse. One who bears the purse. So like, I believe here we have a chief, like a CFO, so chief financial officer here. But that's just our structure here. But like, it would be the person that is the like financial person in all encompasses within that office and stuff. So I learned Latin the other day, too, which was nice.
There you go. So I mentioned, you know, a school being accredited to use the GI Bill. And we hear the term accredited for a lot of schools. You have to go to an accredited university. You know, the school is accredited through this or through that. What does that mean? And who are they being accredited through?
Man, is that a great question, depending on what you're looking at. When we talk about accreditation, accreditation can mean a lot of different things. And I don't have the breakdown right now with me. I should have had that. If we think about it, I try to scale it to things that like I understand or maybe other people that don't do higher ed. If you get a driver's license, you are getting a license to do something through the state, right? And you are accredited within that to drive a vehicle within certain weight classes and other things and whatever, because you've passed those type of marks. And that's more state level run, but also similar to, I think the example I used the other day is when you go to the doctor, how do you know that they're a real doctor? I know it sounds really dumb, but when you think about, well, who decides and has these things? So, you know, when you go somewhere, you're not getting some snake oil person that's going to do whatever. Right. Yeah. So usually it'll say like board accredited, board certified, those type of things, either through the state licensing board. Usually medical professionals have to be state licensed on top of accreditation from their boards and other things. So when we say accredited and we're talking in the college sense, that is that school is allowed by the Department of Education to award certain degrees of a certain level. So for here at LCC, we can give certifications and associate's degrees. We are not accredited to give out bachelor's degrees. We don't offer them, right?
Yep.
And that's not what that looks like. So when we talk about that, we're looking really at two different mechanisms, right? We're talking about, because accreditation, that's the Department of Education, the Secretary of Education chooses which accrediting bodies for us and most institutions that people interact with. It's the Higher Learning Commission. That's the one that has a different accreditation. And all of it comes down to money, as we've talked about when we say like people that usually when it comes down to funding, they either have to all or nothing. They all or nothing the GI Bill, they all or nothing financial aid. And there's institutions that can choose not to, that would allow them to choose and do different things. And I'm not just saying religiously affiliated, because there's plenty of religiously affiliated, like we talked about Notre Dame the other day, like they do both of these things, right? You can have a tie and cross over with religion. No big deal. But if you choose not to do that, you don't have to follow other rules. Certain schools don't have to follow Title IX because they're not choosing to interact with financial aid and other aspects within those things, mm-hmm. which sounds like really wild.
Yeah. We had discussed the other day about schools that don't use financial aid at all mm-hmm. and what that can look like. So that was...
If you're ever in question of a school, honestly, like, there's great Wikipedia articles on the school and just seeing what's the accrediting body mm-hmm. and seeing what it is. Because even ones that you would get commercials for, sometimes they get in trouble.
Yeah.
And they get their accreditation pulled. We're in the age reference where, like, I can say that, like, ITT Tech, mm-hmm. they got in a lot of trouble because they were not following the guidelines in which to award the degrees. And they were, like, the colloquial term would be, like, degree mill. Mm-hmm. You just pay us money, we'll give you a degree. So they got in trouble, got shut down, did a bunch of stuff, whatever. And then schools after that, they don't have to take those credits either. Their accreditation, if anything, forbids them from actually giving that. We've run into situations like that with students where they're like, well, I got this here. And I go, we don't recognize that.
Yeah.
Not that we don't. We're saying, haha, like, you're not good enough. But, like, we legally can't accept that because it's like money laundering, but like credit laundering, essentially. Yeah. So
while we're still on the topic of credits, credits versus clock hours. So that's something that I know some of our GI Bill students, we mm-hmm. run into. But
when you say clock hours, are we saying billing hours or clock hours?
That's a good question. What's the difference?
So when you see clock hours, where are you seeing it?
When I see clock hours, it usually has to do with like trades, on the job training, things like mm-hmm. that.
Yep.
But I know that it can be used in other ways as well. I've seen it used in other ways. Mm-hmm. So from an academic standpoint mm-hmm. here, specifically at LCC, what could it mean?
Yeah. So when we talk credit hours, credits are the way in which we quantify how much time a course, you will get the instruction, how much time and how difficult the course will actually be mm-hmm. to do. And there's requirements within there, like we have to have teaching and stuff. Like we're talking about, we're going to be doing this 15-week semester starting in fall. So we had to adjust literally how many minutes classes are going to be, like adding 10 minutes. And I know it sounds goofy, but it all, again, comes down to making sure we're coloring within the lines, making sure we're doing the stuff that we should do overall. But when we talk credit hours, like also it's a good scale of how much time you will be spending, not just in class, but also outside of class, studying, writing papers, doing other things. Many of our math classes here would be 4 credit hours. Mm-hmm. Our pre-calculus class is a mixture of pre-calc and trigonometry. That's just a way that we had figured out to work the gap. That's 5.
Okay.
So when we look at that, and I talked to that about students, 12 credit hours, which is considered full-time for the Department of Ed and also for the VA, is comparable to like a 38 to 40-hour work week. It's not 40 hours you're in class, but it's 40 hours collectively of everything that you're doing. Mm-hmm. Not in the beginning of the semester, but like mid-semester, like you're going to feel it in certain aspects, right?
Yeah.
Of what things look like. Does that track?
Yes. Okay. So how does that equate then to billing hours?
Man, should I look that up instead of just off the cuff doing this? But I'll do that. Billing hours is also the function of what type of, you've probably seen this when we look at certain classes of, because there's the credits that you get to be able to graduate, mm-hmm. but sometimes the classes and the equipment or the expertise is going to be higher than that. And not just, you can't just throw it in course fees necessarily. So you've probably seen, like, for our aviation classes, are the bill hours and the credit hours the same?
No.
Exactly. Because it requires special facility, special training. You know, we could teach English in this room. We couldn't teach welding in this room, mm-hmm. right? We couldn't teach the power plant and airframe maintenance courses in these rooms. So it's an adjustment of that way. So it actually shows up what it looks like for bill, because you can't have it 1-to-1 ratio of credit hours, because it doesn't track. Because again, one class costs a lot more based off of equipment, and you can't just put it in course fees, because again, there's like legality around that. It's a lot of Department of Ed stuff, ruling, and also crosses over with the VA and even state mandates to make sure we're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But really that comes down to, when we talk clock hours, and not to get people confused, because there's like, if I'm teaching a class, it's tracked in clock hours and stuff. That's completely different. It's how do you quantify someone in an internship that they did that many credit hours, 5 of credit hours worth of work. Mm-hmm. An individual of ours is in their last semester doing business internship. If they just do 2 hours for that 5, you know, that's not going to scale, right? So clock hours need to equate in some equation back up to the amount of credit hours. And there's requirements again from HLC or the Higher Learning Commission. So credit hours is the thing you actually see in your transcript. Bill hours is actually how much the stuff costs. And then clock hours is if you're doing internships and some other on-the-job site stuff.
Awesome. Okay. So we talked about having requirements for certain things. So when we get into actual classes and things like that, we're talking about prerequisites and co-requisites.
Yeah.
And I know that you have to go over that a lot with students.
Yeah.
Can you explain what those actually mean?
Yeah. So when we talk prerequisites, it's, and again, requisite, I just feel like that's a very...
It's a fancy term.
Yeah, it's very fancy for something sounding, but really it's what are the requirements, requisites, that you have to have done before you can take that course. Many times for a lot of our students, it's, we use three different levels, read, write, and math here. It could be from ACT, it can be the free testing that you get on campus if you want that. It could be your high school GPA, other things. And we like, it scales up to, okay, we know that if you take this course, you need to have X level of this. For one, for us to show that people are being passed and we're not just being jerks and taking your money. And then two, when you go to the next course, you're prepared. So it has to be this like fine balancing thing. We've gone back and forth for a lot of things. It's usually math, because math, if you get college level reading and writing, you have that for forever.
Mm-hmm.
If you go beyond for certain math, there's very, very, very few positions or things, unless you've already graduated, where you're actually doing that higher level math. You're not doing calculus in your day to day unless you already have a degree doing that. So they want you to like retest and do that every once in a while. But prerequisite could also be, we don't want you to take a higher level psychology without taking intro to psychology, because you don't have the foundational knowledge to understand what these higher level classes are. When we talk about co-requisite, co-requisites come from, again, financial stuff. When we talk here, it's that for state funding models or other things, we can't just have you take remedial classes. When we say remedial, that would be not getting up to college level. I know it's kind of like, people don't love that term, but depending on what federal office you're talking to, they still use the word remedial.
Yeah.
But not getting up to college level. If the class starts with a zero instead of like a 1, 2, 3, 4 all the way up, it's something like that. And it would help you get to college level. So a co-requisite means you have to take them at the same time. Some programs like our airframe maintenance, cybersecurity, I think has some other courses like that where you have to be doing stuff at the same time. Or for me, I know I had like a capstone class in my bachelor's where it had to be, the co-requisite requirement was it had to be my last semester. So the requirement was you have to be doing two things at the same time,
okay,
which can be really confusing.
Yep. One that I come across a lot, and I know that this has come up in conversation in our office, is traditional versus non-traditional students. I have an idea of what that means.
I want to hear your
VA
idea
standpoint.
Yeah.
But I want to know like what it means on the LCC side or just the academic side. So from a VA standpoint, traditional student is going to be your usually 18 to 23. This is, you know, they've gone from high school into college, and then non-traditional are most of our veteran, are like true veteran students, not dependents, but true veteran students who didn't go to school right out of high school. You know, they joined the military first, now they're coming back. That's how the VA usually views traditional versus non-traditional. How does that look from an academic side?
Yeah, so that would be stereotypical, and that is also a naming or nomenclature structure, because it inherently assumes that like one is better, right? That doing it in a time frame, and many of the conversations that I have with students are, I'm behind. You're allowed to feel that. That makes total sense. I felt that at different points when I was in college, for sure. It's more so treated in a, there's lots of literature and research around it. And my master's definitely like tracked over with that for like non-traditional. When we talk traditional versus non-traditional, it's an age thing. It usually comes down to at what point are you entering college versus your whole like life cycle. You can go the other way and say a non-traditional student would be someone that like, and I've met with some students here, they're 15 and they're in classes at college level. That would be non-traditional because they're like the track and the pathway that most people go about doing. And again, I equate it back to other things. And I say this because I think we just got our like, hey, your W-2s or whatever.
Yeah.
Like there's this standard deduction that applies to most people. Most people do those things, but there's a lot of other different paths and other ways to do those things. So it's not necessarily tied to any aspect outside of what you would consider in the life cycle of a human, of what we're doing at different ages, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those are skewed anyway. So it's more of a, how I said I was a first gen student. My dad went to college at night, but then was like, I'm not going to finish.
Mm-hmm.
He was non-traditional. I choose to call myself that because in me pursuing the traditional college path, like when we both went to Central in that same year, I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't have the support structure. Not that my parents didn't care and like wouldn't talk me through stuff and other things, but they also didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a loose term, but really it just tracks with age most of the time.
Okay. So now we're kind of getting into some of just the random terms that I've come across.
Mm-hmm.
What does matriculate mean? Because I've heard that word so many times, and I don't think I fully understand what it actually means.
Where have you heard it at?
Mostly when we're talking about, like, media. Like, it'll come up in a movie or a TV show, mm-hmm. and it is there's no context around it at all.
I hate that. When we talk matriculation, it's usually, like, you applying and getting in and then getting out.
Okay.
So if you matriculated into the Army, what would that be?
So if you're getting in, so you're enlisting and then getting out is...
Right. So they don't call it matriculating in any way?
No. You're enlisting and then you're discharging.
Yeah.
So
it's pretty much that. Getting in and matriculating and then getting out and like going through the whole like life cycle. That's usually what it means.
Okay.
In the context for it. I can't remember the last time I've had that word brought up.
See, and that's the thing is when you mentioned when we first got started was some of these terms we just hear from media.
Yep.
And there's no real understanding of what they can actually mean.
Yeah.
Another one is practicum.
Yes. What do you think that means?
I have no idea.
Really?
When I've looked at going back to school for a bachelor's or for a master's, I've seen it listed, and I assume it has something to do with hands-on kind of stuff. Like,
yes.
I almost equate it to clinicals, but that's just I'm at with my stuff. So.
No, that's perfect, actually. Practicum, when we look at that, clinical in your sense would be different if you are pursuing psychology, because, like, your background's in psychology and stuff for those listening. Clinical would be, like, actual hours. And it's funny that you say that when we've talked about getting an intern. And for me, they would be doing practicum hours with me because I'm not a licensed counselor, right? So they'd be getting experience doing work that's either the exact thing or adjacent to it. Again, when we talk like medical and medical like related type fields like psychology and other things, they have to do clinical. So actual like with a licensed person under that medical profession. But practicum is doing that stuff and doing the thing. Sometimes it can be an internship. That's what that can look like. Or it can be like when I was at Central, like practicum wasn't set classes. It can be tied to credits. It cannot be sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Practicum in this way was also like me working on the radio station at Central. That was practicum stuff because I'm doing a thing that's tied to my education and what I'm doing, but it's within like a controlled environment, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. And then one that I come across daily, I know you come across daily, is FERPA.
Yes. FERPA. Yeah. Man, people freak out about this one. The Family Educational Rights Privacy Act. As you can tell, I've had to many of things for that. I relate it many times to most people because I have them sign a release if they want to talk to me about certain things. It's related to HIPAA.
Okay.
It's similar but different to that, where I'm not federally allowed to talk about certain items. If a student is attending here, not to out you in this moment, but like you're taking a class here.
Yeah.
I can't talk about your stuff related to education to someone else without you signing off on it legally. A big part of this is, and what gets confusing, is that it doesn't mean when you turn 18. It's not like a legal thing in that way. It can be students that are dual enrolled. There's a whole other process for that.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had students where they're 17, 16, other things. And then parents are like, this. And I go, I do it more eloquently than this because it doesn't go over well. I go, well, I can't talk to you, and then hang up the phone. It's not a good way that I'll make friends with people, right? But making sure that I can't share certain information. There's certain things you can share and certain things you can't share. Some people treat it like this horrific thing that like is going to get you, and we have to like other things, and other people can be more loose about it.
Mm-hmm.
But really it's, I can't share your education info with other people, even if other people ask, even if they're their parent or guardian or other things, because inherently sometimes those might not be safe relationships for those people.
Yep.
And like, and this is not like a new thing. This has been around since I believe 67, 70s. I'm going to get the date wrong, but it's around for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. For anyone listening, this your entire life, there's FERPA for, but it's for higher education only. So.
Okay. And I know we do run into that on occasion, mm-hmm. especially on my side of things. We have a lot of dependents that are using GI Bill benefits.
Yes.
And I've had to have conversations with parents who are calling in wanting to know certain things mm-hmm. about their student and where they're at in their education and things like that. And the response that I tend to get is, but I'm the parent. Mm-hmm. I'm the veteran. Mm-hmm. They're using my benefit. I need to know these things. Mm-hmm. We also have to have that release on file for that student to tell us that it's okay for us to have these conversations with you.
Right. I feel like I've yapped enough. I feel like people got the word salad of higher ed and we maybe circle back to this.
Yeah, I feel like you've answered all of my questions on this one. So,
well, join us next time because I'll be reversing it to Rebecca
yes.
of all of my military questions, which a lot of things I ask every single day. But a lot of ones were using terminology every single day. It was quite a learning curve for me too. So join us next time. Thanks for stopping in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to B2B, Boots to Books.
Thank you for joining us on this journey through the inspiring stories of veterans and military-connected students.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your community.
We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us on social media or take a listen to previous episodes at lccconnect.com or your favorite streaming platform.
Remember, every story is a step forward.
And together, we can build a bridge from boots to books.
Until next time, stay strong.
And keep moving forward.
Sharing the voices of Lansing Community College. Visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Lansing Community College's dual enrollment program offers the opportunity for qualified high school students to earn college credit while working towards their high school diploma. Dual enrollment lets students receive educational advancement in areas where the student's interest is displayed, especially in courses and academic areas not available in the student's high school. To find out more information about dual enrollment, visit lcc.edu.
He has an overbite that makes him look like a cartoon character, a slightly crooked eye, and an uncommonly wrinkly neck. In the right light, he can look a little like a garden gnome, and he'll wear a bow tie just because. Sure, you might call him a little quirky, but that's exactly what makes him so perfect. Tuna is a 3-year-old Chihuahua Dachshund mix with more than 700,000 followers on Instagram. And it all started because he was adopted. You can't buy a best friend like Tuna, but you can adopt one. Help us save them all at bestfriends.org.
The Adult Enrichment Program offers community members the opportunity to discover the art and skill of creative welding and metalwork. Those who are brand new to welding or have years of experience can create their own projects. From sculptures and wall art to functional metal pieces, this class, taught by LCC welding faculty, is open to all skill levels. Visit lcc.edu/keeplearning for more information.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
It's time for Stars on Sports,
a podcast radio show dedicated to sharing stories about our athletic program at LCC, past and present.
Lansing Community College Athletics has a strong tradition.
25 national championships.
Over 190 All-Americans.
19 MCCAA All-Sports trophies.
Stars on Sports will introduce you to individuals that have contributed to our program's success and give you the backstory on what it takes to develop it.
We'll also dive into and break down the topics and issues facing athletic departments across the nation and right here at LCC.
This is Stars on Sports.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Stars on Sport. I'm excited today because we are joined by our head cross country and track coach, Jim Robinson, and our producer today is Stephen Cutter, who is in a new chair. Coach Robinson, welcome. Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk about cross country, Lansing Community College, and you know your background a little bit. Start with that a little bit. What inspired you to get into coaching, and what was your journey a little bit?
Okay, so I've always been a runner. I love sports, every sport really, and got started when I was in junior high school. I was about as tall as I am now, a little over 6 feet, 6'1" and a half. And when I was in junior high, I weighed 112 pounds. So I was tall, gangly, and got cut from every sport I went out for, except track and field. They let everyone do track and field. And I wasn't fast, so I gravitated toward the distance runs. But I describe myself as mild manner. I have a competitive streak. And I think I have one attribute that's really good for distance runners, and that is, I guess, stubbornness, maybe.
I already stole one of my questions from the day, but good.
Persistence. So anyway, I just stuck with distance running. Did it in high school, had the opportunity to continue running in college, and then continued to train and race really into my 50s. But I always knew I would enjoy coaching. I was in a different vocation, and when my son graduated from high school, I don't know if you've ever been to a track meet, but he was involved in cross country and track and field. Track meets, I love track and field, but they go on forever. And I figured, okay, if I just use the time that I spent watching my son in track and field, I could use that in coaching and it would be about the same amount of time. So I started coaching. There was an opportunity. They needed a cross country coach at Portland High School. So I applied, and that was my first coaching experience. Then went from there to here at LCC, first as a volunteer, then as the assistant coach for cross country. Chuck Block was the head coach, great mentor. When he retired, I was retiring from my day job.
Okay.
So that worked out really well. I just sort of slid into the head coaching job, and I've been here for about a decade as the head coach. Been here for 20 years, actually. I started in 2005 as a volunteer.
That but, crazy to you? But, 20 years? It seemed like
it
20
is.
Years?
It is. I mean, it's hard to believe it's been 20 years. But I really enjoy it. Turns out I really enjoy working with the college age athletes. So I'm glad things worked out the way they did.
And so are we. You are cutting yourself short in a lot of areas, Coach, including you ran in college, didn't you?
Correct. So again, this is pre-internet. I'm going to reveal something about how old I am. Maybe that's already obvious. I grew up in Pennsylvania. So I know I'm in Spartan country here, but I went to Penn State. And
good Big Ten school.
I don't remember just how this worked out. Maybe when we were there visiting, you know, doing the application process, they gave us a booklet that had the information about athletics. But I wrote the head coach. I don't know how I would have even known who the head coach was without the internet.
You can't search it online.
Yes, you can't research it online. But I wrote the head coach and told him about my experience running in high school. I was an okay high school runner, but I was certainly not a D1 recruit. I knew obviously Penn State was a big school. They probably have a better program than some little private college. But I didn't really have an idea of the levels of competition. So I wrote him a letter, told him about my high school running, and he wrote me back a card and told me when practice started.
Wow.
So I had the opportunity to run at Penn State, even though I was, you know, not a, a D1 level athlete. But it was a great experience. The head coach, Harry Groves, is in the Coaching Hall of Fame. I think he was our... I mean, he was a very accomplished coach. I think he was chosen as the head coach for one of our world championship teams. He was the distance coach for one of our Olympic teams. He's in the Hall of Fame. And again, I didn't know what I was getting into, but it turned out that I was there, I think, during the golden era of distance running at Penn State. We had two American record holders on the team. I can't think of any other college team, not even Oregon, that had two American record holders that set the American record when in college.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Oregon's had plenty of American record holders, but they've broken the records, you know, post-college. So we had two American record holders. We had a third guy that wasn't an American record holder, but he was NCAA champion at the 6 mile.
Wow, so you're on an impressive team. I didn't know all that. I knew you ran D1.
Yeah, but. No, I was on a team with some really, really good runners. Okay. And we had five Olympians on the track team while I was there at Penn State, one Olympic silver medalist.
Well, I didn't want you to cut yourself short, but now I'm even more impressed.
So I got to see what track and field and cross-country running was like at the very highest level. And that's been helpful.
Yeah.
Even though I saw it from behind.
that's a great segue into, again, our cross-country team here is very successful, you know, in tribute to what you have carried on and, you know, national champions 4 years in a row, two on the women's side, two currently on the men's side. You know, there's so many directions we can go here about your approach to the season, but the sustainable excess. So let's try to tackle those a little bit. Like, what's your training approach? Because, you know, the one thing I've learned from you over the last couple of years is the mileage increase from high school to college can be significant. But again, we have a lot of success at a level. So what's your training approach heading for the season as a whole?
So again, going back to Arthur Lydiard, I think the thing that Arthur Lydiard discovered by trial and error that sports science, again, he was 1960, was before the modern era of sports science, but sports science has confirmed what he discovered by trial and error, and that is that every distance event from the 800 up to the marathon, the key determinant is your aerobic engine, your heart-lung engine, and how that supplies oxygen to the primary muscles you use. Those are your leg muscles. And the best way to train that heart-lung engine and that energy supply system is by running. And the sweet spot for elite-level running is about 100 miles a week. That's still true.
Okay.
If you look at, let's say, Grant Fisher, who's currently the top American runner, he's probably running about 110 miles a week.
Okay.
Maybe a little more. But, you know, for marathoning, that sweet spot has advanced. Again, we have better shoes now, so that might be a factor that you can run more.
Technology definitely
injured.
Helps.
But, you know, the elite level marathoning is maybe 140 miles a week.
Okay.
But even the top level mid-distance runners are probably running 100 miles a week, 90 miles a week.
So is that what your base, your kind of practice plan
on? So, yes. Now, again, if you take someone, let's say, from a local high school who's been averaging 35 miles a week, you can't throw them in at 100 miles a week. That's that was the mistake I made in college because the coach said to us as freshmen, you know, if you want to be a good runner, you got to run 100 miles a week. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to run 100 miles a week and just wearing myself down. So you can't just jump in at that level. But let's say you have a high schooler who's been running 35, 40 miles a week. So the goal is to increase that every year. So maybe as a freshman running 45 to 50, and then as a sophomore, 60, 65, as a junior, 75, 80, as a senior, 90, 95, if they're redshirt 1 year and they're fifth year, year senior. What are they going to be at? 100 miles a week. Mm-hmm. There's that sweet spot. And then, again, given how much talent they have, they'll be in contention if they're running at that level and they developed over those 4 or 5 years, they'll be at the level to contend to do really, really well. Okay. And if they go on after college to, let's say, try to make the Olympic team, you know, they'll bump that up to 110, 120 miles.
So that's, again, so that's your motto for your program.
Yeah. Okay. And one of the things I tell people when I'm recruiting them is that, you know, I'm not going to coach you as if I'm just your coach for 2 years. I'm going to coach you as if this is a 4-year college and I'm going to be, you know, assuming a redshirt year, I'm going to coach you for 5 years. So we're going to do the first 2 years of what your training program would look like if I were going to be your coach for 5 years.
Okay. What's your favorite practice? If you're putting a practice plan together, what did that
entail? You're smiling, so what?
Well, I just like seeing people run hard and run fast.
Okay. So is that a distance run or the a repeat?
No, a distance run. Okay. I mean, if I get on my bike and I'm out there and they're cruising along, I enjoy that.
Okay.
We do a lot of running at what's called tempo pace.
Uh-huh.
And so those would be longer intervals, you know, maybe thousands or miles. And I get to watch, you know, usually we're doing that in a loop so I can see them.
Okay.
A lot of practice, unlike other sports like baseball and basketball, you know, the coach gets to see virtually everything that's going on.
Okay.
A lot of what happens in distance running, you know, I just send them out and they do it and they're really out
of
sight.
Yeah.
But when we're doing tempo running at thousands or maybe miles, I'll get to see them do their loop. And so, I just like seeing people run hard.
This is a bizarre question. Is music a part of practices now more than it has?
Every now and then have a person, I'll see them, you know, they'll have their cell phone, they'll have earbuds in.
But
I tell them, I'm old school. I tell them, no, that's a hobby jogger habit. You know, elite runners are listening to the rhythm of their breathing and their heart rather than distracting themselves with music. So, I mean, you know, if you're going on an easy run on your own, then you can do it your way. But at practice, no.
So there's certain.
And the other thing is safety. If you're on a river trail, you can't hear anything going on around you if you got earbuds on. But particularly if you're running on streets, you want to hear as much as your eyes alert you to what's going on, your ears do in terms of,
there's
a car coming up behind me, or there's a car zooming through
good
this
point.
Intersection.
Okay, let's switch over to recruiting. What's your recruiting philosophy, and at this level, recruiting the base and foundation?
You have to have people with some talent. First off, I have to give credit going way back to Denny Meyer, and then my predecessor Chuck Block.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a really good program, and LCC's been known as a really good distance program over the years. So that's made the job of recruiting easier. Any of the coaches that have been around this area for a while know that we have a really good running program, and that preceded me. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying.
And that helps with recruiting,
right?
Winning helps.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I try to start in the greater Lansing area.
Okay.
But we get runners from really all over Michigan every now and then from out of state, but mostly Michigan. But in general, they come from schools that have previously had a runner go here.
Oh, interesting.
And so their coaches are familiar with the program.
Oops.
Or the kids themselves. If it's more recent that someone's been here, kids that are still in high school have heard from them, like, oh, yeah, I'm having a great time at LCC and I'm getting a lot better. So that's how, generally speaking, I initially make contacts. I mean, I do some cold recruiting. You know, we'll go to some track meets and walk around. You know, you get out the performance list from the area and look down it and say, okay, Holt has a pretty good runner. Let's go see if we can find who he is. But I don't know how it is in the other sports here, but probably the number one thing that is a challenge in recruiting is the stigma that somehow community college is a lesser level of competition and maybe for not as bright students. Neither one of those are at all true. I mean, I've had athletes that have gone on and gotten PhDs in particle physics. I just got an email back. We're having an alumni event coming up. Got an email from one of our top runners. She was here before I was the coach, but she's a physician in the area. So, you know, she got her first 2 years here, got her undergraduate degree, went off to med school. So, we have... I think our women's cross country team, what were we, the second in the conference or nation with our GPA?
First, I believe.
First,
yeah.
Okay.
3.7.
Anyway, we've had a lot of very, very smart
academically athletes, and athletically. Yeah.
And then in terms of athletically, particularly in our sport, I mean, the way cross country and track and field are organized, except for our championship meets, the other meets we go to, most of them are hosted by NCAA D1 school. Yeah. So you're competing.
And we compete well against
them.
Yeah.
So they get to compete, against
other,
every level of collegiate.
Plus recruiting that shows other coaches they can maybe run for their team too.
Yeah.
What do you attribute to recruiting success? Is there one variable? Is it pipeline? Is it winning? Is it our location? Is it our tradition? What do you sell our kids on mostly? Is it our campus? We get a lot of compliments on our campus.
You know, I think it's all of the above. I think one factor is the cost.
Okay.
We can get the cost down to zero in terms of tuition for almost all of our athletes. And even if you're coming from out of area and renting an apartment here, it's still going to be significantly cheaper dorm and meal plan at a four-year college. So cost is definitely a factor.
Okay.
I think the tradition of excellence, so the experience that they're going to have. We do have a beautiful campus. Whenever I have the opportunity to talk to trustees or administrators, I thank them for that, because when people come and take a tour, they're impressed. I myself am a fan of architecture, and I would not go to a school or let my kids go to a school that had an ugly campus. and then I've never had to tell a person, oh, no, don't come here. If that's the academic area you want to pursue,
that
we're really weak in that. You know, you're going to handicap yourself if you start here. I've never had to tell someone that. So our academics is a plus. But, you know, the main thing we're selling is that we have a great cross-country program, great distance program. If you want to be a good distance runner, I think you can improve as much here as any school anywhere in the country.
Developing students, that's another big one too. Good.
So,
Coach, I got a couple more. Do you got anything you want to definitely hit in? Or
just, you know, I was thinking you were talking about distance and tracking mileage. And, you know, with technology today, it's pretty easy to track mileage. But how were you tracking it when you were running in college at Penn State or even prior to that? How'd you know how far you were running?
Yeah. So, again, now the watch is do it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it tells you. But, you know, going back to not wearing earbuds, listening to your body. So you got to know what pace you were running.
Yeah.
So if I went for a 60-minute run, I knew what pace I was running. I could look at my watch, 60 minutes. I'm running at 6 minutes a mile. You know, I just ran 10 miles. If I was running easier, I ran 9.5. I was usually within a tenth of a mile.
Okay.
We had a guy on our team. He was really amazing at this. Again, we didn't have these modern watches. We just had a little, you know, stopwatch. But I remember once it was wintertime. It was cold. It was sleeting. We were supposed to run, I think, 10 miles. And we got back. And the dining hall, that was about the only advantage you had of being on the team, is that they let you go to the closest dining hall, regardless of where you lived on campus. And that one was open like a half an hour later than all the others. But it was like 10 minutes from closing. And again, we just run for an hour in the cold and sleet. And George Christopher looked at his watch and he goes, I got another tenth of a mile to run.
Wow, that's impressive. I mean, that you do utilize.
And he was probably right.
Knowing your body and knowing your pace. And that's what you try and teach kids is, like, you know, even like when they do 400, what's a 60? What's a 65? I ran cross country in high school. And so when I go back to my hometown, I always laugh. Like, our coach would go out and drive before practice and see, this is 2 miles, this is 2 miles back. Or they'd always, with an orange wheel, he would be a measuring wheel that he would use. So like when I go home, I'm going, hey, when I get to Blackmore Street, that was our 2-mile, 4-mile course. So using your car to measure course, because you wanted to change it up, and it's integrity. I mean, I can't say there weren't days we skipped and found a shortcut back through a course. No shortcuts, Cutter. But that's
the other thing. We would have courses that we would do, you know, routinely. And some of them had been measured with a car, or, you know, we just knew what that
distance was. It's funny when I laugh now.
So,
and up until 4 or 5 years ago, you couldn't even wear a watch while you were running. Now everyone wears a, I mean, you don't even need a big clock up there, because everyone does it on their watch now.
And again, I actually did have a fancier watch that did all those things, but I've gone back to just a watch that works as a stopwatch. But
stopwatches were big for coaches. They could tell by how far you were gone, how long you did. So what's your favorite course, Coach? Do you have a favorite course that you've either run on or coached on or been a part of?
Race course?
Yeah, race course.
You know, our Grand Woods course.
We get a lot of compliments on it.
I think that is one of the favorite courses of college athletes in Michigan.
Really?
I often have coaches tell me, or athletes, that, oh, you're the LCC coach. I ran at Grand Woods back when I was in college. It was my favorite course.
Okay.
I like having our team train there.
Uh-huh.
And so, again, I don't think I ever ran a race there myself, but I've run there a lot myself. It's a nice
because
course.
Because in other parts of the country, they have cross-country designated courses. Like Louisville, Terre Haute, Wisconsin.
Right. And now some of your top cross-country colleges like Wisconsin have, you know, they've built their own dedicated cross-country course.
Okay.
I know Oklahoma State has a dedicated cross-country course.
So that's becoming more common, but not much in Michigan. There's a couple, Shepherd and others,
right.
But not much. But
not much.
So our home course is one of the favorite.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think in terms of,
I don't change.
You know, I have certain routes that I used to run that some of them are favorites. I live in Grand Ledge, and we have some nice parks in Grand Ledge, so I have a couple trails that lead from my house to a park, and I'll do loops in the park. And
what's the farthest you've run in a race? Or
you know, when I graduated from college, the pinnacle of distance running was to go to the Boston Marathon.
Okay.
So I've actually done the Boston Marathon 13 times.
Oh, wow.
And I had done it 12 years in a row. My goal was, I knew I was never going to win or be top 10, but my goal was I can have a streak, you know. And so I had done it 12 years in a row, and then I got injured, and I didn't do it. So, I mean, what's the good of a streak if it's been broken? So I didn't go back. I didn't go back for years until the 100th anniversary in 96.
Okay.
And I wanted to go to Boston for the 100th running of the Boston Marathon. So that was my last marathon. But I've run 26 or 27 marathons.
Okay, wow.
13
so
Boston.
You run marathons.
So I run marathons. But two quick stories. One, when I was in college, I organized a group that went down, and Maryland had this 24-hour relay where you you could have 10 people on your team, and you could run repeat miles. So again, if you had 10 members on your team and they all ran 6-minute miles, your turn would come up once an hour. So over 24 hours, you would run 24 miles.
Okay.
But our team started with 9. Well, I could only talk 9 people into going to doing this.
I wonder why.
And as the night went on, several people dropped out. So I think toward the end, we had 6 people. So my turn was coming up, you know, like every 35 minutes or every 40 minutes. But I ended up running 33 miles.
Oh, okay.
Now, not continuous.
Right, but still
but over 24 hours. That was probably one of my best athletic efforts ever. They did a prize for, you know, the fastest average.
Okay.
And you had to run at least 24. You could count your top 24.
Okay.
So you could, you know, not count several. And I had done 33. But if you took my top 24, I averaged just over 5 minutes a mile.
Wow.
So that was one of my best athletic efforts ever.
Nice.
And I was worn out for like 3 months after that. I mean,
so then when you're training,
you know, it took me a long time to recover from that because it was hot, muggy.
Oh, recovery is important.
Summer.
We're not.
And then the other story is my very first Boston Marathon. This is a longer story, but I'll keep it shorter. I had a friend that went with me. He talked me into going, and he was in a wheelchair. And we ended up staying, again, this is pre-internet. So I looked up in the Yellow Pages, the phone book, hotel chains, and I called the Best Western Boston. Well, the Best Western Boston actually ended up being the Wakefield Inn. And that's the last stop on the commuter train north of Boston. So it's not even in Boston. So anyway, I did the marathon, 26 miles. Didn't go well. But then I had to get back to the Wakefield Inn to get our bags. We were taking the bus back to, I was in grad school in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
It didn't go well. I had planned this all out, and I thought, well, it's not going to take me that long to run this, and you know, I'll have plenty of time to catch the train. And Patriots Day is a holiday.
Uh-huh.
So when I looked at my watch, I realized, oh, the last train is like 20 minutes from now, going out of North Station where the Boston Garden is. So I ran I figured I didn't have any other way to get there to make sure I could get there and wow. catch that last train. Uh-huh. So I ran 2 miles to North Station. Then I had to run like a mile and a half from the train station in Wakefield to the motel. And then I had to run back with the bag. Oh, these are old-fashioned suitcases, you know, the type
really? Of handle. That's a post-race workout. So
it added up to, again, like 31 miles.
Wow.
So that, again, was one of my, even though the marathon itself didn't go well, that was one of my, in terms of stamina, one of my top athletic achievements.
Okay. Anything else from you want to share?
We mentioned the national championships. Mm-hmm. Pre-pandemic, this might not be as well known, but in track and field and cross country, mm-hmm. they didn't have a Division II. We're a Division II community college.
Right.
For our listeners, what that means is that mm-hmm. we can give athletic scholarships, but we don't have dorms, mm-hmm. and we can't give scholarships to help with room and board. D1 can give scholarships for room and yep. board. So they recruit a lot of international athletes,
yep.
particularly, you know, our main competition when we were D1. But up until the pandemic, we were D1 in cross country and track and field.
Mm-hmm. And still D1 in track.
It's still D1 in track and field. But we won 2 women's championships, 14 and 15 is D1, and we won them with all local runners.
Wow.
I haven't taken the time to do this, but, I've been around for 20 years, mm-hmm. At least in the modern era, post-2000, I don't think there's any other school that has won a D1 cross-country championship with local runners. So I'm, you know, proud of our Michigan distance runners.
Yeah, right. Well, again, we still run at a high level without, you've had some international students. We haven't even talked that. And again, we have local kids on our current team that have won a national title.
Yeah.
And I would argue this year's team could compete at the D1 level that is coming back. They're that talented. And we look forward to following them, and we will have you back. But until that next time, we're going to sign off with Go Stars.
All right, Go Stars.
Stars on Sports is recorded live at the WLNZ Studios. Engineering and production assistance are provided by Dedalion Lowry, and you can listen to the episode and other episodes of Stars on Sports on demand at lccconnect.org. To find more information about our athletic program, visit lccstars.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to join us next time for more Stars on Sports.
Go Stars! Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
LCC Library empowers the Lansing community to learn, teach, and discover. Located on the second and third floors of the Technology and Learning Center at the corner of Capitol and Shiawassee on LCC's downtown campus, the LCC Library's ambient spaces are available to the public for work, study, or quiet personal projects. In addition, those with memberships at collaborating libraries are free to check out materials from the LCC Library's collections. For more information, visit lcc.edu/library.
Hey there, this is Dedalion, and I want to invite you to join me for a show called Behind the Connection. It dives into what's happening behind the scenes here at LCC Connect. It also provides you early introductions to new podcasts, some of the Connect initiatives that we are putting forth, and of course, insights into the concept of building the voices, vibes, and vision of LCC Connect. Find out more about it at our website. It's lccconnect.org.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The Lansing Community College Job Training Center provides opportunities for individuals to earn several work certifications in 3 months or less.
Career training options are available both online and in person, covering a range of careers,
including healthcare, automation, IT, accounting, and more.
A complete list of LCC Job Training Center programs can be found at lcc.edu/jtc.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.